But the more people we can get insured through opening up Cover Oregon, it's going to reduce the cost of premiums across the carriers. It's going to reduce cost in hospitalizations. It's going to reduce the cost of medical equipment.
This is Public Radio's Best. I'm Matt Laubach. This week, we bring you a legislative healthcare town hall forum with Cover Oregon's Trish Bonert, Lane County Health Department's Dr. Patrick Ludke, and state epidemiologist Dr. Katrina Hedberg. You've seen the ads and you've heard the fighting in Congress about the Affordable Care Act, but what substantial information has the media given you about Oregon's health exchange? On today's show, Cover Oregon's account manager Trish Bonert gives us the lowdown on how the system works and describes some of the plans offered to the uninsured. She spoke at a forum organized by Oregon Representative Phil Barnhart and Senator Floyd Prezansky in late September at the University of Oregon.
Thank you for having me here tonight. I'm here to talk to you about the new Oregon State Exchange. A couple weeks ago, Cover Oregon had a booth at the Race for the Cure. And throughout the day, we had several people coming up to us, and the people that came up to us may not have known about what Cover Oregon was or what we did. The ones that really impacted me were a family who just recently had a baby, had a couple children with them, had just completed the race themselves, and she was very ecstatic that we were now able to provide insurance for them because she and the children have gone without insurance because it was too expensive under her husband's employer's plan for the family coverage. Another one was a homeless woman who has cancer who is currently on the waiting list for OHP. Again, she could not thank us enough for starting the state exchange to help them out. A small employer who had no idea what Cover Oregon was and inquired on it and was very excited to know that he would be able to have choices for his employees that would enable the employees' dependents to pick plans that would financially meet their needs or their medical needs within their family that most employers don't know about their employees and their families. So with all of that, it made me even more proud to work for Cover Oregon and be part of this new beginning for all of Oregonians and be happy to be able to provide insurance for thousands of Oregonians who are uninsured today. Cover Oregon is a new online marketplace where Oregonians can choose from different health insurance carriers and plans that fit their needs and their budgets and access financial help to help pay for their coverage. Cover Oregon's mission, improving the health of all Oregonians by providing health coverage options, increasing access to information, and fostering quality and value in the healthcare system. We have a timeline at Cover Oregon to get started on offering coverages, and it begins October 1st. Open enrollment begins October 1st, and it goes through March 31st of 2014. We are opening it up beginning October 1st with assistance from certified Covered Oregon agents, as well as community partners, to help individuals and families get enrolled at this time. We'll open it up a little bit later for the small employers later on in the month. And the reason we want to take this soft launch is to make sure that we have it right going forward. We want to take this time for those community partners and agents to let us know if there's any bugs in the system. So going forward, we want to make sure that it's perfect. So we're taking this soft launch with assistance from community partners and certified agents to help individuals and families get enrolled. A little bit of background about Cover Oregon. We were created in 2011 by the Oregon legislator. We're formed as a public corporation similar to that of the Port of Portland. And we are a key piece of the Affordable Care Act that has passed. We're custom built by Oregonians. For an example, our customer service center is located in Salem. We wanted to make sure that people, individuals, families, and employers that were contacting our customer service center were talking to people in Oregon. We have many individuals in our customer service center who are very knowledgeable, have come from insurance companies. They're licensed agents, some of them, so they're very knowledgeable. So we wanted to make sure that Cover Oregon was built by Oregonians for Oregonians. A lot of changes with the Affordable Care Act that will impact your coverages. One being you can no longer be denied for pre-existing conditions. So for those with pre-existing conditions today, some of them cannot obtain insurance. They're denied by the individual carriers based on your pre-existing condition. Beginning in January 1st, 2014, you will no longer be denied that coverage. You will have coverage. Yes. All plans through all the carriers must have essential health benefits. Individuals will be able to receive financial help depending on their income level. And the expansion of Medicaid. No longer would you have to be on a waiting list. Cover Oregon is, we call it the one-door portal. We're one door for everyone to enroll and be determined as to what they're eligible for, whether it be healthy kids for their children, the Oregon Health Plan, or the qualified health plans through Covered Oregon. The requirement to have insurance. Everybody has to have insurance in 2014. You go without health insurance in 2014, there is a penalty for not having insurance, and it increases each year you are not insured. We'll talk a little bit about the plans that are offered through Cover Oregon. And on the individual commercial side, there are 59 plans available in Lane County, and there are 6 carriers participating in this area. The carriers participating in the individual market are Atrio Health Plans, Health Net, LifeWise, Pacific Source, BridgeSpan, which is a subsidiary of Regents Blue Cross under the Cambia, Health Republic, Moda, which is previously known as ODS, Providence Health Plans, Kaiser, Oregon Health Co-op, and Trillium Community Health Plans. In the small employer commercial carriers, there are 45 plans available in Lane County and 8 carriers participating. Carriers participating for small employers, again, are Atrio Health Plans, Kaiser Permanente, Oregon's Health Co-op, Providence, Health Republic Insurance, Moda Health, Pacific Source, and Trillium. Rates and plans were just approved or have been approved and certified by Cover Oregon. The total number of plans in the individual market are 102, small group market, 73, and we have HSA-qualified plans, both in individual and small group market. I also wanted to point out that while the number of plans available will vary by county, there will be plans available throughout the state. You'll be able to get dental coverage through Cover Oregon as well, and those dental carriers are Best Life, Guardian, Dentegra, Dental Health Services, Kaiser Permanente, Pacific Source, ODS, LifeWise, Trillium, and Willamette Dental. Carriers are providing benefits or plans by metal tier. So we have a platinum, gold, silver, bronze, and the catastrophic plans, which are only available in the individual market. And each plan represents the health care costs covered by the plan. So examples, the platinum plan is going to pay benefits at 90%, which would make your out-of-pocket expenses 10% for your cost share. So although the plan may pay out more, it may be better for families who really utilize their insurance coverage versus maybe the bronze plan for those who may not use coverage as much. Coverage would be at 60% for bronze plans with a cost share value of 40% out of your pocket. The public medical programs that will be offered as going through Covered Oregon that you would be eligible for, it's Healthy Kids and Oregon Health Plan. The essential benefits with the changes of the ACA, and this will be included in all plans in the exchange and out of exchange with all carriers. Hospitalization, emergency services, mental and behavioral health, pediatric vision care, laboratory services, maternity and newborn care, prevention and wellness, ambulatory services, prescription drugs, rehabilitative and habilitative services and devices. I'll talk about the individual and family coverage. For the first time, individuals and families will be able to receive and see plans, an apple-to-apple comparison with all carriers. As it is today, you're getting quotes or information from carriers directly, but you'd have to go to every carrier to get that information about their plans and rates. Going through Cover Oregon through the portal, you're going to be able to see transparency of plan details with all carriers, rates, everything online. So one-stop shopping. Again, you're determined for what you're eligible for based on your income. So a family, as I said previously, could have children who would be eligible for Healthy Kids, while the parents will be eligible for the qualified health plans. So we're trying to reach out to everybody and get everybody insured in the plans that are going to best fit their needs. Quality coverage and grades, you'll be able to see that for all carriers and plans. And everyone gets help in enrolling, whether by an agent that you may currently use or by our certified agents with Cover Oregon or our community partners throughout the state that have been certified to help you with enrolling. And we have HSA plans eligible for individual market as well. The eligibility for financial help, again, is determined by your family size and your income. With the expansion of Medicaid, the federal poverty level goes up to 400%. So an example of a family of four making a yearly income of $94,200, that seems very high. So it's not unlikely that a family can get assistance making that type of an income in a year. We'll move into the small business market. For the first time, employers will be able to have choice for their employees. They no longer have to worry about, is the plan I'm choosing going to be right for my employees? A lot of you that work for a company know that your employer, when they choose a plan, it may be a carrier that you've had a bad experience with. It may not be the right coverage to fit your family's medical needs. So for the first time, an employer is going to be able to set a defined contribution that they're going to offer towards the employee-only premium, and based on four choices that are going to be offered to the employer to offer to their employees, those employees will be able to choose either a carrier or a plan that's going to fit their budget and their particular needs. Streamline administration. If an employer's choice is the broad choice, it offers all carriers and all metal tiers that employees can choose from. So with an employer, they could have several different employees on all the plans. But the employer is going to get one bill. They're going to get one bill from Cover Oregon. And in that bill, it's going to indicate which employee is on what plan, what metal, and the total premium that's going to be out of their pocket. So it's going to be easy administration for employers. Access to tax credits. Small businesses with fewer than 25 employees and making less than $50,000 in annual income and is offering 50% of a minimum, 50% of the employee-only coverage would be eligible for tax credits. And small employers, too, have access to help through Cover Oregon, through their agents, and through community partners. And businesses who employ fewer than 25 equivalent employees, employees' average annual wages are less than $50,000, the business pays for at least 50% of the employee-only premium, would be eligible in 2014 for 50% federal tax credit. For nonprofit employers, it would be 35%. The single plan employer choice. This is what most carriers choose today. One carrier, one plan for all the employees. Now, if some of you are employers, you know that you have many employees that come up to you, and it's not pretty sometimes. It kind of makes you a little bit nervous, a little edgy, and you worry about it because you want to make sure that you're going to maintain those employees. You want to provide good coverage to maintain good quality employees. So with this, it offers choices for the employer. Carrier choice, again, the employer's choosing the reference plan. We're still using the same silver as the example and the same carrier. But this choice allows the employees to choose from any metal tier within that carrier. So they can choose a platinum, a silver, a gold, or bronze. The metal tier choice. Again, an example shows the silver plan as the employer's reference plan, but it allows the employees to choose any carrier offering the silver plans. And the one that we get really excited about is the broad choice. That's going to make a lot of people happy because the employer, again, chooses their single tier level and the carrier, But the employees all have an option to choose from all carriers and all tiers. There's a lot of choices, and there's going to make a lot of employees and their dependents happy because they're going to be able to set their budget as to what they can afford and the type of plan that's going to meet their family needs. Timeline for employers. In 2014, we're offering it to individuals and small employers from 1 to 50 employees. In 2016, we're going to open it up to 1 to 100 employees in the small group market. And in 2017, it's going to go to 1 to 101 plus. How to apply? Individuals and families through mid-October can go to coveroregon.com or call our customer service at 1-855-COVER-OREGON. You'll be able to be connected to a community partner or an agent with the assistance through our customer service department. If you do not currently work with an agent or know of any community partners in your area, you can call our customer service center and they'll get you in touch with somebody to get you enrolled beginning October 1st. You can search for plans by the area that you live in, by the price of what you can afford, by the provider, by the quality rating. Quality rating would be the customer service level at the carrier or their claims processing time frame. Those types of things are quality ratings. For the first time, you'll be able to see that with each carrier. Plan types, HMO, PPO, point of service plans, you'll be able to see that and choose from those as well. Deductibles, get to choose your deductible level that you would like, your out-of-pocket maximums, and again, the metal tiers, you know, depending on the type of plan that's going to best suit your family. If you don't currently work with an agent or community partner and you would like assistance by one, you're going to be able to go in to our search function and search an agent, whether by a language, if you would rather work with somebody that speaks the same language, spoken language or preferred language, by your zip code, by your county, by your area, and you're going to get a list of different agents and community partners that you'll be able to view their detailed information on. Give them a call, meet them in person, see if they're going to be the right fit for you. But it's important that you work with somebody that's going to work with your needs and help you out. Cover Oregon has a lot of resources for you to learn more about us or to get information. There is our website, coveroregon.com. Our online calculators will help you determine what your tax credits may be. We have fact sheets giving information on how you go about rolling, what's available to you, meetings and events like just tonight. We have email updates. You can go online and sign up for our email alerts and stay connected and find out what's coming now and ahead of you. You could call our customer service, 1-855-COVER-OR. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. You can connect with us in all different ways, LinkedIn, email, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Google. Thank you very much for having me here. This question is, why are you not doing online sign-up for individuals October 1st? There are only two community partners to do signing in Lane County. Why? Multnomah County has community partners. We are opening it up to individual enrollment come October 1st, but with the assistance of community partners and certified agents. And the reason for that is we want to make sure that it's right. We want to make sure that the assistants or the agents and community partners will be able to let us know if there's some bug in the system that we can get corrected right away. After the first few weeks of October, then individuals will be able to go on themselves without assistance. But October 1st, we are launching individual enrollment. And the other part was the community partners. We have over 500 or more community partners throughout every county. I'm not sure where you got that. There's only two in Lane County, but we have several and more grants are being provided to. And you will be able to find that through the website after the first few weeks in October. You'll be able to search for community partners in your area. Okay, this question is out-of-pocket maximums per person or per family? And they are per person, but they max out at 3 per family. So if you have a family of 5, only 3 people need to meet that out-of-pocket maximum. Where is Blue Cross Blue Shield? The Regents decided not to participate in the small group market. They are participating in individual. They're under their Cambia name of Bridgespan. So they are in the individual market, but not in the small group market. This one, my 22-year-old daughter, who is my dependent per IRS, is going to college out of state. Can I cover her on my Cover Oregon insurance? She is an Oregon resident just going to school elsewhere. There's a lot of options for this scenario. One, if you claiming her as a dependent under your taxes, she could be covered under your plan. You did mention that she is out of state. So depending on the state that she's in, if there's a state exchange or if they have a federal exchange policy, she could also get coverage there. Because she is out of state, if she was enrolled under your plan under Cover Oregon, she would have minimal coverage because she would be out of network. There's also student health coverages that are probably coverage-wise and cost-wise better for students. We are not offering student health insurance through Cover Oregon. If they file their own taxes, they can shop through Cover Oregon individually. Over the age of 18, they could come through Cover Oregon and enroll into individual coverage. Student health plans do cover the mandate. They do have the minimum essential coverage, so they would be able to have that and be okay under the individual mandate. Husband and wife. Husband has no insurance. Wife has expensive insurance from employer. Can they sign up as a family under Cover Oregon? Here's where employers need to really decide going forward how they want to offer coverage. For an example, if an employer currently offers coverage to employees and dependents but does not contribute towards the dependent premium, those dependents can still come through Cover Oregon, but they would not be eligible for the tax credits or financial assistance because they have access to other coverage. So it's very important that the employer really figures out what's best for his employees and their dependents. He might want to offer employee-only coverage, and that would allow the dependents to come through Cover Oregon and be determined for their tax credits and their financial assistance. I also want to point out that the tax credits that you're eligible for, even if you have not filed for taxes, when you get the tax credits, you have to be filing in 2014 in order to get credit for those. But you can use the tax credit to offset your premium. And what is really a great tool under the Cover Oregon portal is you're going to be able to decide how much of that tax credit you want to use towards your premium. How much you want to use to make it affordable for yourself. Do you want to use all of it? Do you want to pay your total annual premium? Do you want $50 of it a month applied? You decide how you want that tax credit applied. You don't have to use it towards your premium. You could say, I want it as a refund under my taxes. This is a federal tax credit. If you haven't filed taxes in years or you owe taxes, this is a separate federal tax credit, so you would still get it as a return. They wouldn't apply it towards what you currently owe. So I wanted to make that clear. You use that tax credit. It is yours, and you use it how it's going to best fit your needs, whether for your premiums or take it as your refund. Will she be eligible for assistance? So in this scenario, you can maintain on your employer's plan. So again, it depends on how your employer is going to offer that coverage. So if you left your employer's plan, you would not be eligible for tax credit or financial assistance because you have access to other group coverage. So you're best to find out from your employer how they're going to go about moving forward with their plan in the next year.
That was Cover Oregon's Trish Bonert. You're listening to a Legislative Healthcare Town Hall Forum on Public Radio's Best. Next, Department of Health and Human Services Medical Director Dr. Patrick Ludke speaks on infectious diseases in Lane County.
I titled my talk, The Infectious State of the County, and I'm going to focus on three specific areas. My goals are to talk about vaccine data in Lane County and some of the challenges we're facing in keeping our vaccination rates as high as we would like them to be. Secondly, talking a bit about a sexually transmitted disease outbreak that's been going on and smoldering for about a year in our county, and it's really becoming quite concerning to me. And then finally, I want to talk a bit about what I'm envisioning really to be a partial success around whooping cough or pertussis. And I hope some of the data I present will give you a sense that maybe that is true, and I'm hoping it is in fact true. I can't begin talking about vaccinations without talking about how extraordinarily effective they have been. Before the polio vaccine came out, we had thousands and thousands of cases. But in particular, for paralytic polio, we averaged about 16,000 people becoming paralyzed for the rest of their lives from polio before we had the vaccine. After we got an effective vaccine, we went back to zero cases of this. We almost have no cases. Occasionally have an imported case, somebody who got infected overseas, came into our country and exhibited the condition. This is for America. The United States averaged 500,000 cases per year of measles before the vaccine came out. Many people thinking of measles, they say, oh, my kid may have gotten it if you're old enough to have had a kid before the vaccine. And many people think of it simply as a fever and a rash. And most of the time it is just a fever and a rash. But when you have thousands and thousands of cases, you start to see the terrible, terrible conditions that measles can cause. Measles pneumonia, measles encephalitis, measles death. We used to have many, many of those cases every year pre-vaccination. Now we average 30, 40, 50 per year since we have a vaccine. 30, 40, 50 per year versus 500,000 per year. Extraordinarily effective. Whooping cough. We had almost 250,000 cases per year in the United States before the vaccine in the 1940s, about 200,000 cases per year. Now we average, say, 15,000 to 16,000 per year. That's significantly more than some of the others, but our pertussis vaccine is not quite as good as some of the other vaccines. But keep this in mind as we go through how extraordinarily effective the vaccines have been at preventing huge numbers of disease and death in our country. Unfortunately, we're not using these vaccines as much as we used to. What has happened amongst kindergartners throughout the state of Oregon in the last roughly 12 years? We began with a little short of 2% of kindergartners not being fully vaccinated in the year 2001, and in last year's school year, we were up at about 6% of our kindergartners in the state of Oregon not being fully vaccinated. One of the reasons this is important is because certain of those conditions, of those diseases that are vaccine preventable, they require a very high level of community immunity to prevent that wildfire type of spread where you get a massive epidemic that really changes the dynamic of your society or of your city. A couple of them, measles and whooping cough, are ones that require about 95% of us to be immune to prevent those massive outbreaks that result in closing schools and closing mass gathering sites like movie theaters and such to stop the outbreak. Now that we've climbed up to 6% or so, for a couple of those conditions, we're putting our communities at risk. We don't have the community immunity that we need to really prevent those massive outbreaks. Overall, our vaccination rates for kindergartners have declined significantly. Unfortunately, Oregon is the worst state in the country for kindergarten vaccination rates. We have the worst rate in the country. I wish it were going in the other direction. Let's break it down by county. Oregon has 36 counties. I've been an Oregonian for 2 years, and I've learned that. I can't pronounce them all correctly, but I'm getting to learn them. In 2011-2012, Lane County was unfortunately the third worst of all of our counties for vaccination rate. We were at about 8.5% unvaccinated for kindergartners. That really places us amongst the worst of the worst. We're the worst state in the country for vaccination for kindergartners, and Lane County was the third worst. So I have taken to calling us the worst of the worst. Now, this year's school year, 2012-13, or the one we just finished, we got a little bit better. We dropped down into the 7% range, but we're still not at that magical 95% level or 5% not vaccinated that will allow me to sleep better at night and not worry about a massive measles epidemic where I have to close schools or a massive whooping cough outbreak. And those are concerning issues. So one of the things that we do in public health is, since we don't have resources to address everything, we figure out who is at the highest risk and where can we focus our limited resources to really make the biggest difference. So one of the areas I look at is schools. We have many schools that have more than 20% of their students under-vaccinated, unfortunately. We have some schools where the unvaccinated or under-vaccinated rate is over 70% of their students. Most of them are private schools. Some of them are public schools. We have some significant challenges. And when I hear of a pertussis case in my county, when I hear of some other vaccine-preventable disease case, I immediately focus on, if it's a student, what school are they at? And I get a sense right away of, is this a hot spot? How bad could it get? Now, in some ways, we know how bad it can get. We've had some recent outbreaks of really big concern. In 2006, the state of Iowa had a massive mumps outbreak. It spread to a handful of other states around the state of Iowa, and they ended up closing. It was mostly in university students, but some in high school and middle school. They ended up closing many schools. They closed a variety of dormitories. The state public health laboratory was overwhelmed, and the reason being is we don't have a lot of mumps in our country, so most clinical laboratories don't do mumps testing anymore. We don't need it because our numbers are so low. But they were completely overwhelmed. And I was the state lab director in Utah at the time, and I was helping them to test some of their samples because their state lab couldn't do it. We also have had a recent outbreak in New York and New Jersey with well over 3,000 cases that ended up closing some schools. This is not something that is leaving the planet, so to speak. The numbers have shrunk significantly in the United States, but it's only a plane ride away to go pick up polio, to go pick up mumps, to go pick up measles. And if our citizenry is not appropriately vaccinated, we're going to get those diseases because, again, they spread like wildfire. These are the old wildfire conditions that really scared our parents and grandparents. So you might imagine that this is not only a problem in Lane County, it's not only a problem in Oregon, and that would be true. So consequently, there's a lot of research done in the public health world and in academia trying to understand why it is that people are not getting vaccinated. And most of the research centers on seven questions. The first two are really dealing with education of our citizenry. Many people don't know that these bacteria and viruses still exist. Many people don't think that measles is still around. There's only 55 cases per year in America on average. Well, across the planet, there's well over a million. And again, they're only a plane ride away, and that bug spreads immediately. Number two is they don't know a vaccine is recommended for their children or themselves. And we in public health, we in the academic arena, we in student health at universities really need to get that word out and need to enforce the policies that we already have in place saying that you have to have this vaccine to attend our school or daycare, et cetera. The other five reasons why people aren't getting vaccines are what I would call essentially part of the universe that we live in today and questions of partisan politics and the nanny state and distrust of government and those sort of things, distrust of big business. This is the environment we all live in today. And we in public health as well need to understand those issues and need to have a sense of how it is that we can impact our citizenry to understand how good vaccines are, what their limitations are. They're not perfect, but they're better than getting the disease and dying. And that's something that we in public health have taken on and are moving forward on. One of the things we did in that regard was a few months ago, working with four graduate students here at the University of Oregon, we decided to survey Lane County population, both the citizens and the provider group, doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and get a sense why vaccines weren't being pushed as much in the clinics as we wish they were, and why our citizens are not taking them up or parents aren't giving them to their children. I'll just read a few of the reasons. There was a concern amongst the citizens with ingredients in the vaccine. They've heard about, say, mercury causing autism. Well, it doesn't. They've heard about aluminum in vaccines. Aluminum have been in vaccines for about 80 years. What does aluminum do? They've heard about a variety of chemicals, and they're concerned about that. Some of them are uncomfortable with the vaccine schedule. This one is kind of hard for us in public health. We in America, for example, have a vaccine schedule for babies. 2 months, 4 months, 6 months after birth, you get specific vaccines. In Germany, it's 1, 3, 5, and 7. We kind of have the same genome as people or genetics as people do in Germany. Why is it different? People are questioning why our country did this. I want my child to be on a different one. Why can't we do that? There's a variety of other reasons why people are choosing to not get vaccinated for themselves or their children, and we are trying to address that and trying to help them make an informed decision in public health. There's also some specific barriers to immunization that are particularly knowledge-based barriers. So I hear many in my community health center clinics talking about that, oh, we get so many vaccines these days, won't the number of chemicals in those vaccines just overwhelm the immune system? And it's an interesting comment, but we have good research showing that you need literally millions of chemicals to overwhelm the immune system. And typically in vaccines, the total number of vaccines a child gets in their first year, there's only about 200 or 300 at most of chemicals. So it's not a concern. I talked about the whole autism issue. There are people saying, what about all these religions that forbid vaccines? Well, there's not a single major religion that does. All of the major religions in this country, it depends on how you define major, I suppose, have talked about the need for vaccination amongst their congregations, so to speak. This is not an issue anymore. So we are trying to address these systematically, trying to focus our limited resource in areas where we really feel like we can make a difference. And these are the main issues that we're dealing with right now. Now, I want to do a shout-out issue to the population as a transition into my next topic here about sexually transmitted diseases. The media wants us to believe that we're dying from these sensationalist things. So how many people die each year in the United States from Ebola? Shout out a number.
Zero.
Okay, I like that number. Zero. Worldwide, about 35. But Ebola is an outbreak type of bug. A few years might go by where there's not a single outbreak anywhere, even sub-Saharan Africa, and we won't get any. There was one last year. About 100 people died. A couple of years before, there were none. Okay, commercial aircraft. How many people died in 2012 in America on commercial aircraft? Zero for the last 2 years. Now, this year, we all know there was a crash in San Francisco just a few months ago and two people died. But nobody died on commercial aircraft in America in 2011-12, despite the media wanting us to be scared to death sometimes about commercial aircraft. Shark attacks. How many people die in America of shark attacks per year? Less than one, okay? Plague. Two people. Lightning strikes. Now, people who live in Oregon have probably never seen lightning before. I haven't seen it. I've been here 2 years. I haven't seen a single lightning strike, which is the first place I've ever lived without lightning. But across the country, between 50 and 100, the average over 10 years is 55 per year. What about tornadoes? Quite a few more, and we've had some pretty tough tornadoes in the last few years. Close to 100 per year on average in the United States. And finally, the flesh-eating bacteria you've all heard about and seen nasty pictures of. 100 to 300 per year. We don't have enough data to average it in a statistical way. But this is what we are led to believe by sensationalist reports, by Hollywood, by others. The numbers are actually very, very small. Tobacco, obesity, and alcohol, these are the number one preventable causes. What I'm talking about are also preventable. The numbers are smaller, but they're potentially explosive as well. They could potentially cause huge numbers of death and disability in a very short period of time. So let's move to sexually transmitted diseases. I'm going to talk about three in particular that have been increasing in number not only over the last several years, but over the last about 12 months. Chlamydia is a bacterial infection predominantly seen in women, but also in men. And the numbers in Lane County have increased significantly from about 1,000 up to about 1,600 now. This year, we're on target for 1,650. It's, as I said, specifically increased in females and a bit up in males as well. This is a concern because it can result in sterility. It can cause problems if the mother is pregnant. It's a problem condition in our community. Gonorrhea is an even more significant problem because it can actually kill people. Chlamydia rarely does. It's possible to get a more systemic infection, but it's pretty rare for anybody to die from chlamydia. Gonorrhea can cause more problems. Over the last 3 years, we're up to the possibility of a 400% increase in gonorrhea over the last several years. And we're on track right now. I think we're going to end up with 160 reported cases that are confirmed by laboratory testing. Many of you I know will say, well, what does that mean? That means that we actually have a lab test and it actually came back and it actually said it was gonorrhea. It wasn't strep throat or something else. It was gonorrhea. Well, as you can imagine, many people don't report it. Many people take antibiotics from their sexual partner and we never find out how many there are. This is the absolute minimum possible number. There's probably well over 1,000 cases. This is a huge number and it's quite frightening to me. And we're not alone. Oregon has had some significant increases as well across the state. These numbers are frightening to all of us in public health. Syphilis as well increased quite a bit. Now, we don't have a lot of syphilis. This is not like chlamydia where we're talking about thousands of cases. We're talking about dozens of cases here. But across the state, the numbers are really, really high. This is all across the state. We're looking at several hundred cases of syphilis, mostly in men who have sex with men. But when these outbreaks stay around for a long period of time, they unfortunately bleed off into the heterosexual population. We've seen that time and time again. So with an outbreak that's been lasting for well over a year, we know what's going to happen. And I think I just saw somebody whisper on their lips, HIV. You're right. This is what we're worried about. We're worried about if we have this smoldering epidemic of these potentially curable sexually transmitted diseases, we're at risk of getting these incurable conditions such as HIV. We haven't seen a big increase in HIV in Lane County yet. There has been a bit of an increase across parts of the state. We're trying to prevent that. So one of the things that we did, and I'll talk about in a moment, was to have an STD summit. But let me help you interpret some of the data I just presented. First of all, if we're talking about a 400% increase in gonorrhea, has our population increased 400% in Lane County in the last 3 years? No, we've gone up less than 1% in this county. So that's pretty sobering, 400% increase versus a 1% population increase. Have we improved our surveillance systems? Did we get a bunch of federal money or state money to have better surveillance systems and get doctors and nurses to do more testing? No, we haven't. If anything, in actuality, we've done less testing because of budget cuts. Have there been other changes in treatment? Have the bugs become antibiotic resistant? There have been a little bit of changes. We don't think they're significant, though. The Centers for Disease Control has recommended a few changes, especially in what we call expedited partner therapy for gonorrhea, where if somebody is positive, we can give them drugs and they can treat themselves and their partner. We got rid of that about 2 years ago. So there have been some minor changes. We don't think they've made a big, significant difference in these numbers. There have been some changes in Lane County because of budget cuts. We used to have a sexually transmitted diseases clinic every week. We cut that out about a year ago because of budget cuts. I personally feel that we at the health department are part of the problem. We're not the only problem, but we're part of the problem of why our numbers are going up and not getting getting better. We're working hard to try to change that. And then finally, I mentioned the STD Summit. 4 months ago or so, when I saw this problem, I said, it's time to do something. I don't want to have a huge increase in HIV cases. So we called an STD summit on May 23rd. We got about 50 people from the community, mostly docs and nurses. The Student Health Center from the University of Oregon is represented. Lane Community College Student Health Center came in. We had a two-hour meeting, 7 o'clock in the morning, to talk about these numbers and what we can do together to make sure the HIV numbers don't go off the charts, because we don't want to have a disease like that, or any of these other diseases as well. I think that we've made a difference. I wish it would have been a bigger difference, but this is a concern to me, sexually transmitted diseases. So let's finish up with whooping cough. A typical sneeze, the particulates from the sneeze travel up to 6 feet, about 100 miles per hour, interestingly, and people who don't cover their coughs are of concern to us for all respiratory conditions. And why whooping cough is of big concern to me, we've been sandwiched between two massive outbreaks of whooping cough or pertussis over the last couple of years. California in 2010-11 had the worst outbreak in 70 years in the United States. They had about 10,000 cases of whooping cough. They had well over 1,000 hospitalizations, mostly among babies. Whooping cough is really a nasty, nasty bug for the young. They had 10 deaths of babies, a terrible, terrible outbreak. And last year, Washington State had a very similar outbreak. Smaller numbers because their state is significantly smaller in population, 617% increase year over year. They had huge numbers of cases. Their state health officer called it an emergency, gave out free vaccine, ended up having clinics throughout, sponsored by the state throughout their state, and it was a big, big problem. So here we are in Oregon, and I want to remind you, the worst vaccinated state for kindergartners in the country, sandwiched between two states with nasty, nasty whooping cough outbreaks recently, and I think we're pretty clearly at risk. So what has been happening to us in the last 6 to 12 months? Year to date, for this year, from January 1st, 2013 until today, actually, well, noon today, we've had 100 cases of confirmed and presumptive added together. 93 were confirmed, 7 were presumptive cases. Compare that to last year, there were only 23. So our numbers are up pretty significantly, 435% if you like the percents. But they're not at massive epidemic proportions. And I personally feel that what we've done in public health and with our community and clinical partners, we've made a difference. We've gone out and given these 100 vaccine clinics. We went to Lane Community College. We went to some of the ethnic Central Americanas, Latina places, giving 100 vaccines of the pertussis booster to a variety of places. And I really think we've made a difference. And I think that our 5 hospitals and the sites that have labor and deliveries, we've talked to them about cocooning around moms and dads because the babies are most at risk. So make sure mom and dad and grandma and grandpa have gotten their whooping cough booster vaccine to protect that baby, because the baby's immune system can't get the vaccine yet. They're not mature enough. It takes a while before the baby's immune system can handle it. So I'm cautiously optimistic about whooping cough. I don't have warm fuzzies yet, and I am not sleeping well yet. But I feel like we're getting close to the point where we're making a difference in whooping cough. But thank you for listening this evening.
That was Department of Health and Human Services Medical Director Dr. Patrick Ludke. You're listening to a Legislative Healthcare Town Hall Forum on Public Radio's Best. Next, State Epidemiologist Dr. Katrina Hedberg speaks on chronic disease in Oregon.
I grew up in Corvallis, and so, you know, I'm quite familiar with Oregon and what's been happening here over time. And I think right now, I work for the Oregon Health Authority. And, of course, right now we are at the forefront of health care reform in the United States. We have the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, you all know what's happening in the federal level. And here in Oregon, the health authority is is in the process of rolling out coordinated care organizations with the triple aim of improving population health, improving experience of care, and also decreasing costs. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the upstream things. Those really cannot happen. We can't improve population health, and we can't decrease costs, really, without thinking about some of the primary factors that get people to be sick in the first place. So I'm going to talk a little about those strategies, mostly around chronic disease. So epidemiology really started a couple hundred years ago in London, where there was a man named John Snow who was looking at where the cases of cholera were occurring. And it turns out that they all clustered in one area around the Broad Street pump. And part of this is that the water that the Broad Street pump was pulling from all came from the Thames. The Broad Street pump pulled water downstream of where the sewage went into the Thames. So people were getting contaminated drinking water. And so John Snow did the obvious thing, and we always really like this as a public health intervention. He removed the pump handle. So people could no longer get the water out of that part. Now, this is before germ theory of disease, et cetera, but he saw that if people were getting water from pumps that pulled it out of the Thames, upstream they would stay healthier. So even without knowing all the root causes, he was still able to have a public health intervention that worked. Not all of our interventions these days are quite as simple. When we look at the public health advances over the past century, there are a number of them. Vaccinations, infectious diseases, sanitation, antibiotics were non-existent 100 years ago. They came around just before the Second World War, and we've made huge advances in the control of infectious diseases. Safer water. I don't know how many of you have traveled in developing countries, but here we turn on the tap, we put water in. I'm bringing my water straight from Portland, and it's terrific drinking water that we're able to get right out of the tap. That's not true in all parts of the world. Motor vehicle safety. A lot of times people think about public health in the infectious realm, but actually things like seat belts and airbags and car safety overall has really limited the number of deaths that occur from car crashes. Safer workplaces, things like black lung disease and other hazards in the workplace, we have been able to control. And finally, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about the recognition 50 years ago with the Surgeon General report that tobacco use really contributed to a number of chronic diseases, and we've been able to recognize that and are still working on tobacco control. So the leading causes of death, again, back in 1900, were infectious causes, pneumonia, influenza, and tuberculosis. And by 2000, those had shifted. And these are all chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, stroke, lung disease, and diabetes. Now, again, the thing to look at is not what people are dying from, because I can tell you right now, from what we know, mortality is 100%. We are all going to die at some point. So the real issue is not that. It is what is happening with premature causes of death. And so when we look at the diseases that occur, we're really looking at what are some of the risk behaviors that are happening upstream that we might be able to address in order to limit premature death. Tobacco use, physical activity, and diet, there isn't a one-on-one link. We all know that lung cancer, as an example, the primary risk factor for that is still tobacco use. On the other hand, there are people who get lung cancer who've never smoked at all, and there's plenty of smokers who don't get lung cancer. So the correlation is not one-to-one. Tobacco use also contributes to heart disease, stroke, etc. These, we know, they're upstream behavioral causes that manifest themselves in a variety of chronic diseases. What the premature causes of death are in Oregon, they really fall in three groups, and then they continue from there. Infectious disease is still on the list, motor vehicle crashes, etc. But the three leading are tobacco, by and far the largest number. Every year, upwards of 7,000 Oregonians die prematurely from tobacco-related causes. Obesity comes in second with 1,500 deaths, and alcohol third with 1,400. And again, microbial agents, toxins, et cetera, there's a variety of other things. But in my talk today, I'm going to really focus on these three leading causes of death. So cigarette smoking, I had mentioned already that it was back in 1962, the Surgeon General's report, and in the 50s, the prevalence of smoking, particularly among men, was about 50%. It was very high. And it has declined since then. And so overall in Oregon, since 1996, it has continued to decline from 25% downwards to about 20%. So the point is, it is declining, but we still have our work cut out for us. Tobacco is a very, very addictive substance, and so it takes a wide variety of strategies to really help address the issue of tobacco use. And tobacco use among eighth graders, there's been a steady decline. On the other hand, we know from more recent data that some of these youth, while they may not be trying cigarettes, they're trying things like e-cigarettes or chew tobacco or snus or things like that. So they're still experimenting with other types of tobacco. Smoking by age, the groups that are really at highest risk are young adults. Now, I'm in the mid-50s category, and I can tell you it's a rare 50-year-old that wakes up and says, I think I'll try a cigarette, and becomes a lifetime smoker. So what's happening is that youth are experimenting, and that's one of the reasons we're so concerned about what happens among middle school, high school, and college kids. Often they're leaving home for the first time and experimenting, and so we're really concerned about what happens to young adults because they are the ones who become addicted to nicotine and potentially obviously have a lifetime of addiction that they need to deal with. Another way to look at smoking and use is by socioeconomic status. Not everybody and all populations smoke similarly. It turns out that folks of lower socioeconomic status, the prevalence of smoking is about 37%, in contrast to folks of higher education and socioeconomic status down at 13%. So part of this means that when we're trying to help people quit smoking or not start in the first place, we can't necessarily, I mean, we certainly have media campaigns that blanket completely, but we need to be using strategies that really target those at highest risk. Whether they're youth or helping people of lower socioeconomic status, they also have a greater burden because, of course, tobacco is expensive and costs the same whether you're well off or not. When we look at community interventions to address tobacco, one of the strategies around tobacco control really is to limit access. Now that means there aren't vending machines, for example. When I was growing up, every motel had one. Every restaurant had a vending machine. Those aren't true. Cigarettes are no longer a place where people can get them. They're behind the counter. They're often at the customer service, or you have to really ask. So when it makes it more difficult to get a hold of cigarettes, again, that's a disincentive for people to continue smoking. Increasing the cost of cigarettes also limits the number of people use. That's called price elasticity. That's kind of a fancy word to basically say that the more things cost, people tend to use less of them. And that's definitely true with tobacco. Smoke-free air policies. Again, here I think we're quite lucky at the university system. Two biggest ones, U of O and OSU, both have tobacco-free campuses. And we're looking at that. I mean, Starbucks, you know, in Oregon, there's clean indoor air and also within 10 feet. But small businesses like Starbucks have said you can't smoke within 25 feet of our business. So businesses are allowed to implement things that are more stringent than the state law. And finally, we do use media. So I think, you know, people are often shocked, but media has really changed drastically. It used to be that one of the ways that tobacco was advertised is that, you know, doctors smoke this, not a single case of throat irritation. Oh, this is just terrific, right? And, I mean, we now laugh about this, but this was only 50 years ago that these ads were commonplace. And as you know now, tobacco is no longer, we're not able to advertise it on TV and billboards and in magazines, etc. That is not true, however, for new products like e-cigarettes. They are not controlled by the same advertising that tobacco is itself. So our media today, we in public health, do have counter-advertising because we know media works, obviously. There's lots and lots of money that go into this. And it's not just aiming at people to keep them from starting, obviously, making sure that people who are current smokers, as I mentioned, nicotine is an incredibly addictive substance. And so we make available to folks Quitline, it's a 1-800 number, and we link people to their insurance or to counseling services, nicotine replacement therapy, and health insurance, etc. So again, part of this is that we don't want to say, well, it's only for adults can smoke, but kids can't, because then it becomes sort of the forbidden activity, if you will. So part of the strategy has to be helping adults who are current smokers stop, as well as trying to prevent kids from initiation in the first place. So I'll talk a little bit now about obesity. Simply, being overweight is too many calories in and not enough calories used. So anyone who's had a problem with weight knows that even though that's very simply put, it's a lot harder to perhaps either limit intake or increase physical activity. People wonder when we use the term obesity epidemic, why that word, because epidemic is often referred to infectious disease. Epidemic really means, to epidemiologists, it means the pattern and distribution of diseases in the population. In Oregon, simply, we have gone from, in 1993, from around 12% obesity to currently it's upwards of 25%. So if you add overweight to that, 60% of adult Oregonians are either overweight or obese. So we can't even talk about what's a normal weight anymore, because what's normal is to be overweight or obese. So we have to talk about healthy weight. And, of course, it isn't just adults. It affects our kids. And it's even harder. Adults have difficulty sometimes with controlling, obviously, weight and concern about diet. But if someone has started off as a child being overweight or obese, it's even harder to change those habits as an adult. Over 60% of young eighth grade men exercise. That means 33% don't. It's slightly lower among girls, about 50%. By 11th grade, that number has dropped for both of them. So it shows that both boys tend to be more likely to get physical activity than girls. And it changes over time to 11th grade, and then that decreases even more. 60 minutes per day for more than 5 days a week. And for adults, it's more like 30 minutes a day for 5 days a week. And we sort of changed the standard, but the numbers continue to decline. Adults are much more sedentary than kids. So when we tell people, well, gee, why don't you just, instead of taking your car, walk a couple of blocks to the store or whatever. So a number of the policies that address this are things like making sure that there's sidewalks, that people can walk safely. Make sure there's parks and green spaces that people can use. Mass transit. Even the amount of time you take walking to the bus and then taking the bus and walking, that's physical activity as opposed to a car that goes door to door. Encouraging physical education in schools, PE classes, of course, there's been a lot addressed about that, and sports in schools to make sure the kids stay active. And again, people drive less. You know, when with the economic downturn, gasoline prices went up and people drove less. So people are also sensitive to the cost of gasoline. So on the food side of things, the super size me and the big gulp, I think, is an issue. As humans, and I'll speak for myself, what the food that gets put in front of me, I usually eat it. If there's a doggy bag, I might take it home, but I often have second thoughts. It's extremely difficult for me and for others, I think, to leave food on the plate or to say, I've really had enough. Well, there's just one more French fry or whatever. And so this, the idea of supersizing or big gulp, I think, is really tempting people to eat more than they should. So the idea here is not that people should never have a French fry. I like a French fry, too. I like my little piece of chocolate every day. But it's really making sure that people have choices, making sure that there are healthy food options close to where they live, whether it's restaurants and stores, availability of farmers markets. Again, vending machines are sort of where tobacco vending machines were a while ago. It's very hard to get healthy food out of a vending machine. And now, at least, we've started to address in Portland, I'm not sure about here in Eugene, but vending machines in schools and what hours they can be sold and whether it's soda or candy bars or those kinds of things are not in the school setting. Menu labeling around consumer education. And then again, looking at food subsidies. Part of the reason that McDonald's and other fast foods are cheap is because they are subsidized. Federal farm policy subsidizes them. So I'm going to end a little bit with alcohol, and I'm really going to focus on binge drinking. And binge drinking is five or more drinks in one setting. The percent of adults in Oregon who report binge drinking declined from 2001 to 2002 and then has been pretty steady around 15%. So that's a lot of people who are binging. Men binge drink more than women. It's, again, the young adults who tend to binge more than older adults, similar to the tobacco use. About 25% of 11th graders report binge drinking, and that's pretty steady over time. 8th graders, it's a little less, around 10%. But again, this is really problematic, and I know these stories, especially on college campuses, of youth who, whether they're taking shots at a party or whatever, and then I guess it was a few years back where somebody at MIT, really smart school, but ended up getting acute alcohol poisoning and dying. So these things are not just related to the car crash. Alcohol is a poison. Looking at deaths by age group, overall, when we're looking at the rate per 100,000 residents, it's around 35%. It increases with increasing age, but the deaths are completely different. Obviously, the 15 to 24-year-olds are dying of those alcohol-related car crash, injury, occasionally the poisoning. The 65-plus-year-olds are dying more of chronic alcoholism. And there are a number of policies that we can put in place as well. Dram shop liability has to do with if somebody goes into a bar and then they're visibly drunk, that the server does not continue to serve that, or there is some liability for the person who's doing the serving. Limiting hours of sale, so again, that bars can't be open indefinitely. And the same with grocery stores, even if you're selling alcohol, that you can't sell it past midnight, for example. Alcohol outlet density has also been shown. These policies, by the way, are things that have been studied at the national level as being evidence-based and effective. Similar to what I said, both with gasoline and with tobacco, increasing the price of alcohol has decreased use. So that's another aspect. And finally, I'm really enhancing the enforcement prohibiting sales to minor. My kids are both in college, and I remember a couple of years ago my daughter had wanted to make a birthday cake, and it included a little bit of rum as kind of flavoring. And I said, well, I don't know how you get that. And she goes, Mom, This is a college campus. So people look the other way, of course, because kids will drink, even though the majority of college kids, certainly not grad students, are underage.
That was Oregon State Epidemiologist Dr. Katrina Hedberg. She spoke at a legislative healthcare town hall forum held at the University of Oregon in September. It was organized by State Representative Phil Barnhart and Senator Floyd Prezonsky. For more information about Cover Oregon, visit their website at coveroregon.com. I'm Matt Laubach, producer of this week's Public Radio's Best. Thank you for listening.